Welcome to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, we're continuing our series called Creating a Next Steps Culture. But before we get to this week's message, we wanted to let you know that one of our mission partners, Hand to Hand, which helps to serve weekend food to hungry kids, is currently in need of jars of peanut butter and jelly, some snack packs, and some drivers who would be willing to deliver food to our partner schools. We also want to let you know that signups for short-term, long-term groups, Bible studies, classes, and a whole host of other things you can get involved in, they're signing up right now. You can find information about both the hand-to-hand signup and all of our groups and classes signups in the Church Center app or by visiting us at harborchurches.churchcenter.com. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim as he helps us figure out a way to burn our past.
All right, if you have a Bible, we're going to be in 1 Kings 19, Old Testament book of 1 Kings. Last week we began a new teaching series. We're calling this teaching series Creating a Next Steps Culture. Creating a Next Steps Culture. And last week we looked at this moment in an Old Testament prophet named Elijah, this moment in his life where it seemed as though the culture around him had turned on one another. They're in the midst of a national pandemic. It hasn't rained in 3.5 years. And the culture turns on each other, and then they begin turning on God himself. And so Elijah steps into this moment, and there is this epic throwdown. We looked at it last week. But essentially, on one end, there are 450 prophets of a Canaanite god named Baal and his female friend, Asherah. She's got 400 prophets. And on the other end, you've got Elijah, and it's just Elijah. And there's this contest. Yada, yada, yada. We looked at the story last week, but it ends with God, like Elijah and Yahweh, his God, our God, the God of the scriptures, winning. What you discover pretty quickly in the story is that the point for Elijah isn't just to win the contest. He seems pretty confident that's going to happen. But the point for Elijah isn't just to win. He's not just trying to prove a point. He's trying to save a culture who, by and large, have missed the point. And so he begins, and you see this right away, because he begins repairing an altar to Yahweh. An altar serves, if you had to put a word on what's the point of an altar, the point of an altar is to serve as witness, to witness to something that happened in the past. So this story takes place on Mount Carmel, where a God has shown up in a number of ways in the past. So an altar witnesses to something in the past. It witnesses to the present, to your faith in this moment, and it witnesses to something in the future, to an upcoming hope. So the purpose of an altar is to tell a story. It's to witness. Now, if you have an altar that's been destroyed or it's not been repaired, clearly you have a culture who has forgotten the point. They've forgotten the point of witness. They've stopped telling the story. And so what Elijah does is he begins to repair the altar. In many ways, the whole story's been about altars. Baal's got his altars. They're working. They're up and running. But there's no God there's no actual God. Elijah says that he's just sticks and stones. And then there is an altar to Yahweh, and it has been destroyed, and he begins repairing the altar. Let me just read you that moment once again, and we'll pick up from there. But verse 30 of 1 Kings 18. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one from each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." 12 stones, one for each tribe. Now, the whole story up until this point has been a flurry of activity. Like, there's been taunting back and forth between Baal and Elijah and the prophets. But I picture this moment slow. It says that he calls the people to him. And then he gets 12 stones. I picture Elijah slowly, as he gets the stones and he begins repairing the altar. I picture Elijah taking this as a moment to remind the people, again, what's the point of an altar? It's witness. I picture him taking this moment and slowly trying to remind his culture, who have missed the point and lost the point, of what the point is. Do you remember who your God is? Do you know who you are? Do you remember how God met us in the wilderness? Do you remember how God showed up for us? The reason we're wrestling through, what do we share this fall? As people are kind of coming out of COVID, our COVID bubbles, our quarantine, what do we talk about in this season? And one of the things we said, what's really important to talk about is, what is it right now in a culture that feels like, if I think this is true for every single one of us, the culture feels like it's turned in on itself. It's like we're creating new ways to divide amongst ourselves. And I was actually really moved last week, Saturday and Sunday, as maybe the first time in at least 2 years where social media actually felt like somewhat interesting to me. So last week, Saturday, was the 20th anniversary of 9/11. You know this. 20 years ago, our country was completely caught off guard in one of the... I was a freshman in college when it happened, and I was watching this week as you all were telling your stories of the events and what you were doing when this happened. And I was most moved by some of the stories of how we huddled our families close. Just hearing, the first thing I did was I called mom. The first thing I did was I checked in on my loved ones. And so last week, Saturday, then trickling into Sunday, I found myself deeply moved for the first time in a few years reading social media and seeing we all felt some of the same thing. For a short window 20 years ago and then a short window last weekend, it felt as though we were trying to remind ourselves that we're in this together. Us humans, we're in this together. And we got opinions on how to move forward, but we're in this together. And I've seen you over the last, especially since kind of COVID, pandemic, the last 24 months or so, I've watched you as a church try to, this sounds creepy when you say it out loud, not watching you. I'm not watching you in the privacy of your home. I'm not Amazon. I can't do that. but I've watched you try to repair the altars as a witness, try to rebuild your community. I've seen all of us, even though we've disagreed on kind of how to move forward, many of us disagree with family members and neighbors on how to move forward politically and culturally. I've watched us try. And I see this in the story. I see Elijah really saying, okay, what does it look like for us to move forward? He takes the 12 stones and tries to rebuild the culture. And the story is really hopeful for a moment, and then it gets really tragic, and then it gets really hopeful again. It's hopeful as fire comes down, the altar gets burned up, the crowd is chanting, Yahweh, he is God. And then the next moment, there's a hit on his life. The king and queen, Ahab and Jezebel, they don't like what just happened, and so they lay a hit on his life. And he takes off running, and we showed the map last week. He runs from here to Cleveland. It was a distance. It was an awful, awful place. He runs, and the crowds that were cheering him on, they don't come with him. And the story ends with, it kind of feels like he's all alone, he tried. And then God meets him in the middle of a wilderness. He actually has a mental breakdown. It's one of my favorite and most tender moments in the scriptures because it's actually the moment I find myself going to with people in my office or who I get to work with and talk to who deal with anxiety or depression. Because Elijah, the hero of the Bible, gets to a spot where he begs God to kill him. He's like, I don't even want to live, God. I don't want to live. I'm lonely. I'm scared. I don't want to do this anymore. And God meets him. And what you discover is, God gives him very subtle and simple next steps to take. It's almost like God meets him and says, hey, if you're going to try to change the world, it's a noble goal, but you got to trust me to do that work. Your job is to listen for my voice in your life. You do the work of taking your next steps and let me figure out how to handle the culture. You figure out your next steps. Of all the places we could go this fall, as we've been praying about it as pastors and leaders in the church, we said, maybe the conversation we need to have as a church is how, What are the next steps we as a community should be taking to move forward? In the seat back in front of you, there is a card. If or when you get bored by what I'm going to say next, take a moment and look at the card. In several weeks, we're going to, on the 10th, we're going to take a step together. Those of you who are willing, we're going to take a step together in one of these areas. There's nothing novel about the areas. These are just seven areas that throughout history, Christians have been taking next steps in. If you want your life to matter or to add up to something, these are the seven steps you find throughout history. God saying, if you step in these ways, this is how you make an impact in the world. So did you know that faith in the Bible is always described as a walk? I remember when I first caught this, how, like, it was like shocking to me. I always thought of faith as a system of beliefs or a set of theology or a set of ideas. But in the scriptures, faith is always described and defined as a walk. It's always described as the earliest Christians referred to themselves as the way. Before they're Christians, they're the way. And what's the way? Well, it's a walk. It's the way of Jesus. It's the way of love. It's the way of forgiveness. It's the way of peacemaking. And so of all the places we could think, okay, what does it look like to take next steps into actually take a walk in our faith? Now, we're anchoring our series in the story of two guys, Elijah and Elisha. Why those two guys? Well, Elijah and Elisha will become the model for the entire rabbinical system. Elijah is the one that to this day our Jewish friends will look back to as the first rabbi, and Elisha will look back to as the first disciple. The entire model. Now, they wouldn't use those categories back then. They wouldn't have called themselves that. But the system was kind of built. Jesus and his disciples, that rabbinical system is built on the example of Elijah and Elisha. Here's why. Let's get into the story. 1 Kings 19, verse 19. So Elijah went from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. Elisha then left his oxen and ran after Elijah. Let me kiss my father and mother goodbye, he said, and then I will come with you. Go back, Elijah replied. What have I done to you? So Elisha left him and went back. He took his yoke of oxen and he slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah and became his servant. That's the story. This is a shorter story. Last week we had a long story. This one's short. Now, one of the things we say often here, so if you're new with us, you probably haven't heard this yet, but for those of you who've been coming a while, you've heard me say often, when it comes to reading the scripture, read the scripture slowly. It's really important to develop a healthy curiosity. What are we reading here? I find it really helpful to ask the questions. Don't assume you know anything. Ask the questions. And even a simple story like this, it seems simple on face value. There are some questions on the story, is there not? Here's a question. Let me just highlight a couple that I have. There's this moment where Elijah comes up to Elisha and he throws his coat on Elisha. That's a weird moment, right? He doesn't say, if you notice in the story, he doesn't say anything. He just comes up to him while he's busy at work, puts his coat on him and walks away. Imagine that's happening to you. That's a weird moment. That is a weird. What is going on in the moment? And then to make it, it's like a drive-by cloaking. To make it, like, it's odd. To make it more odd, you have this detail about Elisha then left his oxen and he ran after Elisha, of Elijah. Why? So it's like, it's almost like he drops his coat on him and then he takes off. Like, what is going on? Elisha's got to run after him. Like, why? What? What a weird story. That's a couple questions I have. Then we have, how about this detail? He does catch up to him, and he says, okay, let me go back and let me kiss my mom and dad goodbye. And Elijah responds with, whoa, what did I do to you? Like, what? Like, he can't say goodbye to mom and dad. Elijah, I think I can say this in church, he feels a bit needy there, right? Like, what did I do to you? Like, no, it's not about you. I just want to say goodbye to mom and dad. To make it more troublesome, many of us who hear this story, if you grew up in the church, we hear this story through another story. Jesus will actually, he'll reference this story in one of his famous teachings on discipleship. So many of us, our first encounter with this story is through the teaching of Jesus. Jesus says this. Jesus said to another man, follow me. But he replied, Lord, first let me go bury my father. Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their own dead. That feels not nice. But you go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Still another said, I will follow you, Lord, but first let me go back and say goodbye to my family. Jesus replied, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God. Let's pause there. Every once in a while you read something from Jesus, and you're like, I don't know that I can disagree with that because it's Jesus. And at face value, like, what? Like, let the dead bury their dead. That's not, I highly recommend if you go through the visitation line in a funeral home, that's not what you say. Like, that's just like come on, what? I'll follow you, Lord, but first let me say goodbye to my family. No one, he's clearly referencing this Elijah story. What is going on? If my boy's seven, if my boy, when he's 18, if a guy meets him in, like as he's at work and puts his coat on him and my kid leaves with him and doesn't say goodbye and then quotes the story, I'm angry, right? Like as, like a dad, you're angry. I'm hurt. If it's a random guy, I'm creeped out first. But if it's, even if it's somebody of noble stature, like if somebody that like we all look up to, somebody that we respect and look up to, at least say goodbye. At least say goodbye. So either in Jesus' discipleship language, he's giving really bad, at least to my ears, it would feel like bad advice, or the story Jesus is referencing here, we've misunderstood. There's got to be more going on in this Elijah-Elisha coat moment. What's going on? All right, let's unpack it. I'm going to walk line by line, and I'll do my best to be quick. I'm watching the time. Line by line through the story. Some observations bubble to the surface. First, the story seems to center around two guys, Elijah and Elisha. Now, at face value, honestly, growing up, I always assumed Elijah and Elisha were related. Seems obvious, right? Like, feels like, okay, like, I'm Elijah, I'll name you Elisha. It feels like, I always thought it was dad and son. Like, Elijah's Elisha's dad, or if you miss this little story, their stories kind of blend together a little bit. So, like, I just always assumed that these two guys were related. I won't put my water bottle on our altar. but they're not related. According to the first line in the story, we know who Elisha's dad is. Elisha's dad is not Elijah. It's a guy by the name of Shaphat. Now, you should be asking questions, and your question should be, who's Shaphat? The answer is Elisha's dad. Other than that, we don't know much about Shaphat. We're not given a lot of details in the story about Shaphat. However, this is the second time Elijah is mentioned in the text. The first time is a few verses earlier, and notice how we were introduced to him there. Go and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as a prophet. Now, why does the author insist twice? Both times we're introduced to Elisha that you know who his dad is. We are not told anything about who this Shaphat character is. However, the assumption is apparently the first audience would have known exactly who this guy was. Apparently, when they read the story, they'd be like, oh yeah, that's Shaphat's boy. So who's Shaphat? Well, let's see if we can piece it together a little bit. Next verse. Elisha was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Now, that's a yoke of oxen. It's two cows, essentially, tied together. That's a yoke. There's 24 oxen. There's 24 cows. That's a lot of cows, right? 24, by ancient Middle Eastern farming standards, is a lot of cows. This would be, to translate it into our language, this would be like, Elisha had 24 yachts, and he himself was driving the 24th yacht. That's a lot of yachts, right? You would be impressed by that number of yachts. I'm impressed. Elisha had 24 mastercrafts, not just any boat, mastercraft. And he himself was driving the 24th mastercraft. You hear this and you think, okay, apparently this Shaphat guy has some money. He's done something right. Now, the other detail we're given there is that he's from Abel-Meholah. Abel-Meholah. Abel-Meholah on a map is here. What does that tell us? So let me show you Abel-Meholah today. We think we know where the city is. It's here. It's under this mound of dirt. By the way, at the risk of nerding out on you, this is referred to by archaeologists as a tell. As a tell. A tell is essentially, layman's terms, it's a giant pile of dirt with history under it. Most ancient cities, it's all about the location. It's all about where you are. So what would happen in the event of a war is that you would just throw, I think I got another picture, you would just throw a little bit of dirt over the ruins of the war and you'd rebuild your city because it's all about location. It's where you are. And so we've got layers and layers of history. The city Megiddo that we looked at last week, Har-Megiddo, Armageddon, that city has at least 18 cultures that we've excavated built on top of each other. So this is Abel Mahola. It is just a pile of dirt, but who knows what's under the dirt? That's, by the way, it could just be a pile of dirt. How do you tell the difference between a tell and a pile of dirt? It's hard to tell. that's my archaeologist joke for you. Most likely it is a city. We'll learn some stuff about the city when we dig up the dirt. It's hard to over-exaggerate how much we've learned in the last 50 years through excavation. It's hard to exaggerate just how much we've learned. I, in 2009, went to the city of Laodicea in Turkey. Laodicea in 2009, they had just begun excavating. And over the last 10 years, so that's the lukewarm city. I'll spit you out of my mouth, that city. We've seen so much. We've learned so much about the culture. Stuff's under the ground. By the way, the revelation thing, Tara mentioned it. I've been here 9 years, and I've been fighting for 9 years to do a teaching sermon series on the book of Revelation. And so at the end of this end of October, we're going to begin a 7-week series on Revelation. To say that I'm excited about that series, there's so much culture and history that we miss the book of Revelation. We miss it because we've lost its context. We've lost its history. Anyway, that's Abel Mahola. I forget why I'm telling you this. Oh, let me show you the map again. Do I have the map? We know some things about, even though it's under dirt, we know some things about it because of where it is. We know some cities around it. We know that this city, it's almost certainly a farming village. Now, the reason it's a farming village is because of some of the cities around it, but also because it's right on the Jordan River. So you got fresh water in an area where there's not a lot of irrigation. These are mountains, but this is flat land. It's fertile land. This is a farming village. This is what Shaphat does. Shaphat's a farmer in a farming village. Now, he's a farmer. Let me show you a picture of an ancient farm. This is helpful, I promise. This is an ancient farm. When you read farming in the Bible, when you hear about like Ruth and Boaz, this is an ancient farm. Let me show you another ancient farm. This is an ancient farm. You find these language throughout the Old Testament of keep the ancient boundary markers. Each family's given a plot of land. You keep your plot of land by taking the rocks as you're tilling your land, and you put the rocks on the wall, and that's how you maintain your boundaries. To this day, some areas of Israel, they're still maintaining the ancient boundary markers. Let me show you. There's another plot. You can see the lines? This is a farm. Do I have another one? Oh, yeah, one more. This is an ancient farm. Now, I show you this because 24 cows on that is too many cows, right? Like, apparently, Shaphat somehow has acquired more farms. Maybe it's by shady business. That doesn't seem so. But apparently, he's got more land. He's well off. The first detail in the story is that we have a man named Elisha whose dad is kind of a big deal. Now, the story continues. It explains a little bit of what happens next. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. This is that awkward moment we talked about earlier. Like, what is going on? He shows up out of nowhere, drops his cloak on, and then leaves. Elisha's just working. This is a day he's done before. He's out plowing the fields. Whatever you do, he's showing up to the classroom, he's showing up to the office, like whatever, his job is to plow the fields. He's out working, and Elijah comes and he interrupts his day. Isn't this how God works, by the way? Like, wouldn't it be great that God, like if God would check our calendars before like surprising us with like a new life adventure? Wouldn't that be great if God's like, let's make sure it works out in your life calendar? Like, wouldn't it be great if you could say, Okay, God, I would love for you to speak to me at 10:55 and give me life direction. 10:55 on Sunday morning, but I've got a brunch with the girls afterwards, so please, like, I'm busy at 11:30. So if you could, like, wouldn't it be great if God, like, looked at our calendars and said, okay, let's coordinate our calendars. But what you find in the scriptures is often in a normal day, my guess is many of you who are married, like, you would tell the story of, like, I wasn't planning to meet anyone, and then all of a sudden, in a normal day, we met each other. Right? It's often in a normal day, you're living your life, and God catches you. Now, the question I've been wrestling with as I think through this is, how many of us we've so bought into, this is my ordinary life, this is what I have, this is my calendar, that if God were to surprise us, well, I got to first clear up my ordinary life, God, so I can do something extraordinary with my life. Elisha is caught, and Elijah throws his cloak around him, and then Elisha left his oxen and ran after Elijah. This is the drive-by cloaking moment. He's just doing his thing. He's living his life. There's just this moment where Elisha chases Elijah. Like, he drops his cloak on, and then he chases him. Now, Elijah is not some random guy. This is a prophet. Why does Elisha chase Elijah? The story before this is this whole contest on Mount Carmel. Elijah's a big deal. So we know why he chases. The whole cloak moment is a way of saying, I think you can do what I do. You can have my job. You can do what I do. And he chases him because you believe I can do what I do. But that sets up the moment of kind of the awkwardness to the whole thing. Because if he does what Elijah does, he's going to have to leave the farm. There's safety in the walls of the farm. But not just is there money and safety and 24 yachts in the farm. The story, remember how the story of Elijah ended? The king wants him dead. If he follows Elijah, he's essentially accepting a call to die. It's also a call to live, but there's risk involved, which makes sense of why the next question he asks is, let me kiss my father and mother goodbye, he said, and then I'll come with you. That's what provokes Elijah's response. Go back, he said. What have I done to you? Now, on the surface, it sounds like Elijah is offended. That Elisha, why, what have I done to you? I propose to you that I don't think that that's a fair read of what's going on in the text. I don't think it's a fair read. I don't think Elijah's offended by him going back at all. It doesn't seem to be the case. It seems that he's not offended by going and saying goodbye to mom and dad. That's not what's going on. It feels as though, actually, the secret is in the word, let me kiss my father and my mother. Now, when we hear the word kiss, we often think affection. We think tenderness. In an ancient world, that is the case at times. But by and large, when you hear of language of a father or a grandfather kissing a son or a daughter, it's almost always about passing along a family blessing. Let me read you, in case you don't believe me. This is out of the InterVarsity Press Old Testament commentary. Kissing between a father or a grandfather and a son or daughter is found in several contexts as a prelude to receiving a blessing and may be implied here. Then it gives you a couple references. Kissing is less about intimacy and more about, I need to go back and see if it's okay with mom and dad first. And it feels like what Elijah's saying is, dude, I'm not forcing you to do anything. I am simply telling you there's an invitation to step into a whole new way of life. My concern is that you may find in going back, you may find yourself stuck and unable to go forward. How many of us have been there where it's like, you can actually see it happening in the story? Like, you can see, like, why is Elijah so far ahead of him and that he has to run to catch up to him? You can almost feel like the head games are beginning as he's plowing his field. Okay, he's offered me a new life. It's a whole new life. If I leave, well, what if? What if I get two steps outside the gate and I get killed as a prophet? What if my dad doesn't like this and he cuts me off? What if? Like, how many of us get stuck in the what if game? The what if game can keep us from moving forward. But the what if game can also keep us stuck in the past. The what if game can keep us stuck. Sometimes it keeps us stuck from moving forward. Sometimes it keeps us stuck in the past. I call this the Uncle Rico effect. Remember the movie Napoleon Dynamite? Where's this going? Napoleon Dynamite, Uncle Rico, there's this scene that comes up again and again of Uncle Rico saying, I bet you I can throw that football over the mountains. The backstory, it's actually kind of a tender moment in the movie. But the backstory in the movie is Uncle Rico tells this story of how if Coach would have played me in the playoff game, then I would have made it to pros. And if I would have made it to pros, I would have married my sweetheart, my soulmate. And if I would have married my soulmate, my life would be so much better. And then he asks the question, is there a time machine to go back? I wonder how many of us, we have these, I made a mistake. My past is, I can't move forward because I have this thing in the past that keeps me back. Sometimes it's pain. It's heartache. Sometimes it's failure. Keeps us back. I can't tell you how many times I've heard some version of I've had my heart broken and I'm afraid of moving forward. How many of us have had our hearts broken? We in a moment of innocence and love said, here's my heart. Please be kind to it. And the person that we gave our heart to was not kind to it. And our heart was shattered. And we found ourselves saying, I'll never do that again. I'll never risk that again. By the way, never doing that again is a guarantee recipe that you will never have your heart broken, but it's also a guarantee that you'll never love again. Sometimes it's what we shrink our future out of fear that we're going to relive our past. Other times, it's our successes. In this story, for Elisha, it's not his past hurt that's holding him back. What's holding him back is his success. He had a successful job. He had a successful life. He has employees. He's got stature. He has the 24 yachts, the 24... It's possible that he could begin to believe that the life he has is the best life he could have. My guess is he could even make it to his dying breaths and convince himself that this is the best God had for me. This was the best God had for me. I did the best. I think that what's going on in the cloak moment is Elijah is inviting him into a bigger future and Elisha knows it. And the, can I go back and kiss mom and dad is a, I'm not sure I can step all the way in yet. And Elijah's response is essentially, I'm not forcing you to do anything. I'm simply inviting you to do more. So will he do it? Let's wrap the story. Verse 21. So Elisha left him and went back. He took his yoke of oxen and he slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and he gave it to the people and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah and became his servant. That's the story, end of the story. Now, archaeologists have discovered an ancient plow. Let me show you an ancient plow. It's an ancient plow. It's not super impressive. You tie two cattle to it, and you'd walk behind. This story ends with Elijah having some kind of a cooking surface. He then takes his plows, lays them on the surface. He then takes his cows, kills the cows, puts them on the plows, and then the story ends. I was trying to think, how do I help you remember this? How about this? He puts his cows in the plows to make chow for the crowd. Wow. He makes steak dinner for the community. That's how the story ends. He makes a steak dinner. Now, I'm reading the story, and I'm thinking, don't do it, Elisha. Don't do it. Don't kill the cows. Sell the cows. You can still go, but sell the cows. You might need that money someday. You give yourself at least a plan B in this whole thing. You may need this money. Do you know how much cows and plows are worth on the market? Me neither, but I'm assuming they're worth a lot. Sell the cows, sell the plows. Give yourself a plan B in case Elijah's this whole following him thing doesn't work. You've got a plan B. I wonder how many of us, what keeps us from chasing the life we want to have, the life we know God has for us, is we cling to our plan B as though it's our plan A. I can't tell you how many people, it's like tragedy. It's like they had their plan A. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to run after this. And then tragedy hits. And it almost as though it takes tragedy for them to realize that maybe they made God their plan B. They get the diagnosis, they go through the treatment, and all of a sudden on the other end, I hear stories, and you've heard these stories. It's almost like I'm glad it happened, they'll say. Because I had shrunk my life down to something like vacations and paychecks and a kitchen renovation. All fine things, but like I had shrunk my life down to something small. And now on the other end, I'm realizing what's really worthwhile. I'm pouring into the people that truly matter in my life. But it took the tragedy of my plan A falling apart to realize that I had made God my plan B. I had made his plans for my life my plan B. Here's a question to wrestle with this morning. Because he then cooks steak for the entire community. Here's my question. Is your past an anchor or an altar? Is your past an anchor holding you back from the life? Maybe it's failures, maybe it's hurts, maybe it's successes holding you back from the life you could be living and you know it. Or is your life an altar where you see everything that's been given to you as an opportunity to witness to what God has done in and through you? To live life with open hands as a gift. Is your life an anchor or an altar? Maybe for some of us, we need to light our past on fire. We call this one how to burn your past. Don't hear this one wrong. We're not talking about burning old relationships or burning bridges that we might have to cross again. That's not wise. We're not talking about being irresponsible and not forgiving people that need to be forgiven or asking for forgiveness ourselves. I'm talking about the excuses we make, and I'm looking at myself in the mirror in this one, the excuses we make to not go after the things that truly matter. Some of us are, you're stuck in a relationship that you know isn't good for you, but you're terrified that if you were to let it go, God may be holding out on you. There may be nothing left. Some of you, it's something in your past where it's like, man, I'm still telling stories of those olden days, and I'm terrified if I were to try again. This job I'm in, I don't like this job. I don't love, it's not, but I'm terrified that if I were to start over and try the thing that I know I'm supposed to give my life to, it may not work out. I'm terrified of it. Sometimes it's negative things. We tend to know when negative things need to be burnt up. Like we know that, okay, bitterness, there's no place for this. Unforgiveness, there's no place. But I think if it's hard to burn up negative things, you know it's really hard to burn up? Successes, right? Success is really hard. When Elisha, in the story of Elisha, is he's got to walk away from success. He's got to leave a life of comfort, stuff. Now, if he would have stayed on the farm, you know who he could become like? Shaphat, his dad. Shaphat, everybody knew Shaphat. He could become a big deal in his day and age. But we would not know his name today. Had he just stayed on the farm, he would have been a big deal in his community and a big deal in his era, but we would not know. He would have been an asterisk in history, an asterisk on somebody else's story. But in leaving and risking it, I think what Elijah says when he puts his cloak on him is, burn it down. Now, the purpose of an altar, again, is to witness, What I love about the Elisha story, if you notice, he lights his past on fire and he gives a meal to his community, but this isn't described as an altar. He's a prophet, but he doesn't leave anything on the altar. What he seems to understand in the invitation of the coat, this weird moment, the coat, by the way, of Elijah is a coat of animal hair. What he seems to understand is that the invitation is not that he were to leave a sacrifice, but that he were to become the sacrifice. He were to become the altar. I think whether or not that's what's going on in his head, that is what's going on in the early church when they understand this moment. Look at how Paul, one of the first Christians, retells this. He says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. I think what our world craves today more than ever is a community who is willing to tell a better story. There are so many bad stories being told right now. And quite frankly, there are so many bad stories being told about our God right now. And so many of us, we have these moments in our life, this pain, this heartache that we feel as though if we were to share those stories, if we were to let people in on that stuff, it would make God look bad. It would make I think the invitation is to see our lives as a living sacrifice. All of these stories of how God has worked in me, all of these moments, all of this life is an opportunity to tell our world a better story about a better God. Now, to get really practical, last thing. On your card, you'll see witness is one of the next steps. We have a couple opportunities that we've tried to put. Okay, how do we actually practically get at this? A number of you, who here has gone through a Bless Lab? Anybody gone through a Bless Lab? We've done three or four of them now. We have another Bless Lab coming up on November 10th. Essentially, it's rhythms for how to tell your story. Really practical stuff. And if you can't make it to those, on our website, there is a whole storytelling section about, there's some books and some resources available that you can read. But our hope is, how do we tell the story better? With that said, would you join me in a word of prayer? Lord, would you make us a living altar as a witness to who you are in our life and in our world. Lord, would you allow us in every place we go, in every atmosphere or environment we walk into, would we be the ones who others look to say, oh, that must be what their God is like. And Lord, in so doing, would they see a God who heals brokenness? Lord, would they see a God who forgives? Lord, would they see a God who loves unconditionally? Lord, would you help us to be a living example, we pray. And Jesus, our hope is that the world would come to know that you are every bit as good as the scriptures say you are. We pray this, Jesus, in your name. And everybody said, amen. Would you please stand?
As always, we're grateful that you would spend a little time with us. For more information about South Harbor Church, joining our community, or any of the things you hear on the podcast, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m., you'll find our service streamed live on both our Facebook page and on our Vimeo channel, which you can find by visiting vimeo.com/South Harbor Church. And so once again, from all of us here at South Harbor and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.